The evolution of the energy sector over the past 25 years has surpassed every expectation. And today, energy forms a key pillar of political and social strategies in many of the world's economies. What are the milestones that got us where we are today?
Welcome to the Smart Energy International podcast, your guide to innovation and trends in the global power and energy sectors.
Hi, I'm your host, Claire Fulton, and thank you for joining us for what is going to be a casual and free-flowing conversation between myself and two of the people I enjoy talking with most. Kevin, who is a technology evangelist.
Hi, my name is Kevin O'Donovan, and I get to spend my time looking at new technologies and innovation right across the energy industry. Now, my background's in enterprise IT sales. Since I finished up at Intel about 3 years ago, I get to share a lot of the cool technologies and gadgets that I see with folks. And in my day job, I do a lot of consulting with companies around technology trends and implications and playing devil's advocate on their go-to-market plans.
And Areti, who is the content director for data at Enlit Europe.
Hi, I'm Areti Daradimu. I'm the content director for data and digitalization for Enlit Europe. And I am very much into data ethics nowadays. I've written my master's thesis on the subject and I'm very keen to learn more about it.
What we're going to be talking about today is the past 25 years of the energy sector. And this, of course, is in line with the 25th anniversary of Smart Energy International. Kevin Areti, thank you for joining me.
Hey, glad to be here.
Thank you for having us.
So, Kevin, perhaps I'll start with you, particularly given your focus on all things tech, and ask how you have seen things change in the energy and power sector over the past 25 years.
So I suppose if you look back over the past 25 years in terms of the amount of different technologies and techniques that have been used across the energy industry, you know, Claire, you could have, instead of one episode, you could have an entire, I don't know, decade of podcasts on this. But I suppose the way I'd look at it is that I think there are two things that stood out for me that drove a lot of other technologies to be adopted and adapted and created situations where we need to adapt quickly. And the two things I'd call out in the past 25 years is fracking in the US and its impact on the world energy markets. And unfortunately, Fukushima and the impact that had. And both of those, while technology played a key role in all of them, before, during, and after, it was the implications of both that I think drove a lot of technological innovation and adaption over the years.
It's a really interesting point because actually while I was just doing some notes in prep for this conversation, Fukushima was one of the things that did come to mind. And it's funny because it hasn't necessarily been topical in the same way that it was, say, 10 years ago. In fact, it is 10 years this year since we had the disaster at Fukushima. And in fact, it was May 2011 because we were hosting an event. And at the event, we all held a minute of silence for the people that had been so badly affected by the tsunami and the subsequent nuclear issues. But it was just really weird to think how that event kind of rolled back so much nuclear. And yet now we're slowly starting to see a sort of gradual uptake again of nuclear technologies around many different areas in the world again.
True, Claire. But I suppose the other thing would have been that, and as you say, the everything around Fukushima and the earthquake and the tsunami was tragic, right? Look at the amount of loss of life and. Mm. But I suppose the fascinating thing in the energy industry was that Fukushima resulted in Germany and many other countries taking a decision to phase out their nuclear power plants, some of them almost overnight. Yep. That led to entirely different challenges around the transmission grid in Germany and across Europe. And the industry rose to that challenge in terms of congestion and that was hard. So that drove a huge transformation that people weren't planning for. And I'd argue that has a benefit, and benefit's probably the wrong word, but that transition led to where we are today with the advent of wind energy and offshore wind energy and the need to drive more renewables because we were taking base load off. I agree with you. There is some renewed interest in some of the new nuclear as a clean fuel going forward. People argue with that, but I do think it's a technology option. And you have all the stuff around small modular nuclear reactors. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly was the beginning of the German Energiewende. You're right, it has had a significant impact, not only on the nuclear industry, but across pretty much the way the entire industry, generation-wise, is now being positioned. Areti, from your perspective, you at Enlit Europe are very focused on data. I wanted to ask you how you have seen changes. I mean, we've had this conversation more than once. We've spoken about how things have changed. But looking back at it from a far greater perspective of 25 years, I mean, what do you think is the most significant thing you've seen?
Well, the rise of artificial intelligence, I would say, and the tsunami that it brings with it. From a philosophical point of view, we can talk about the ethics of artificial intelligence. From technological point of view, we can talk about all the new fancy things that it brings to our power grid. And from a human perspective, the jobs that it will create and the jobs that it will take away. So I would say that artificial intelligence is, for me, one of the most important things of the last 25 years. And let's not forget, AI started, let's say, more than 25 years ago, when some people that now work for tech companies or even for the European Commission, when they did their PhDs in technological universities around the world. And I have the example of Patricia Arsene, the policy officer of the European Commission, used to be DG Connect, now it's DG Innovation, I think. And her PhD back in the 80s, early 90s, was about artificial intelligence.
So speaking of artificial intelligence, I mean, where do you see it being a real game changer from the energy sector perspective?
This is a really, really hard question because it would be easier to say where I don't see it becoming, let's say, a game changer. To be honest, you can run everything with artificial intelligence in the future, of course, not there yet. Let's talk maintenance. It can be done either with AR or with VR also, but AI would solve a lot of problems. We can talk about, let's say, sending robots in a very distant future, of course, correcting our grid and various issues or problems that we might have in weather conditions that are not optimal, let's say. We can have also robots taking over some jobs, and that would be a negative thing, let's say, that some of our fellow citizens are having right now, are doing right now. But I would say that for starters, maintenance would be the number one priority of artificial intelligence.
Kevin, what about you? I mean, I know that you have had comments before with regards to the role of AI in the sector. Anything that you'd like to add to that?
So certainly AI, and Areti is correct, AI is not new. People have been talking about it for many years. And I suppose where we're at today is that AI does mean many things to many people. And, you know, if you look back, whatever, 20, 25 years, artificial intelligence was simply about a technique how a machine, a computer, could mimic human behavior. And I think what we've seen down over the past couple of years is that mimicking human behavior could be in the form of simply following a program, you know, if this do that, right? So that's just a piece of software. What we've started to see over the past, again, depending on what industry and what you define as, say, machine learning, is the software getting a bit more clever in terms of, well, I've seen this before, so that must mean that. Somebody didn't code that. It kind of started running its own analysis. But again, it's kind of classic software. And I think where we're now headed into is the whole concept around deep learning, neural networks. You know, things that learn for themselves in and look at questions that we didn't even ask the machine. And that's still a bit further out there in terms of some of the projections. So when I was wandering around at European Utility Week and now Inlet in the Future, everybody has AI plastered on their wall. And my first question is that, what do you mean by AI? But AI is here to stay. It's here already, and it's just going to get more interesting. I do think people are a little afraid of some of it because, especially in the energy industry, they kind of go, hang on a second. So you're saying that the transmission grid's going to be looked after by a piece of software that I don't understand how it works, but just I'm supposed to trust it? So I think that's kind of the human nature is going to come into play, is that I don't know how it works, so how do I trust it?
I guess if you think about the sort of mandate that the majority of the utilities operate under in terms of reliability and safety, and the fact that engineers generally, I think, like having, and this is a very broad generalization, but I think that they like understanding how something works in order to know that they can trust it. So it's not unusual that there should be some questions. We're seeing the same thing when it comes to self-driving vehicles. People want to know that they can trust the technology that is running effectively their lives. But if I could perhaps take a bit of a step back, Areti, and just focus on another part of what you have been looking at just recently, and that is, of course, the issue of data. Now, we've had people talking about the role of data, and for a while, the whole concept of the data tsunami was obviously very high on everybody's priority list. But the conversation seems to have shifted a little bit away from the amount of data and more to what it is that you can actually do with that data. Any thoughts?
So what I would like to say here is that, yes, you do have a point, a very valid point, Claire. It's not like big data or, let's say, the vast amounts of data are not relevant anymore. Of course they are, and we need to know how to dissect them and how to use them and how to, let's say, lead them towards the correct place. But I think that right now, what we're seeing with data more and more is more on the regulation point. Because I don't know if people know what to do with that data, as you said. I don't know if people know who owns the data, what the rights are. And when I say people, I mean mainly the consumers. We have the DSOs and the TSOs mainly running the show because they are the collectors of the data. But there are some ethical issues there, which should, if they already aren't, although I think that they are, that they should, let's say, run the show. The European Commission, for example, has produced this strategy for data, which has some clear mandates and some clear opinions over data in general, how they should be used, by whom, and for what purpose. And it is, again, a question of people knowing their rights so that they can actually not fight for them. That's very strong, but let's say try to maintain them and do something about it. If did I make myself clear? Do you understand what I'm trying to say here?
Yeah, I guess it's about people understanding that when it comes to their information, even if it is information that is generated via a third party, that they still have the right to assert a certain degree. Personal connection. Yeah,
to a certain degree. I mean, there are many kinds of data. SCADA, for example, data, of course, they do not belong to the people, but smart metering, for example, data, yes, those belong to the people that produce them mainly. However, is that right? Is that the correct way forward? Should I, for example, forbid a researcher use my data in order to, I don't know, conduct a research that perhaps would be very, very good for the greater good, for society in whole. So, you know, there are many, many ramifications, many, many questions raised by data. Mm-hmm. And I do understand why the European Commission and all of us are a little bit confused about the whole issue.
I guess it's also because data can be used in so many different ways.
Yeah.
And in some cases, it's in ways that you can't even imagine until somebody does it. And then you're like, oh, I didn't think about that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a body like the European Union would have to try and consider every single possible angle while trying to come up with a policy that's also not so restrictive as to make all of that data completely useless, but also not so producers to make a completely, complete anarchy out there either.
Yeah, totally. You're absolutely right. But this is, let's say, where ethicists should also get in and give their opinions, right? It's not only about the tech people. It's not only about the activists. It's not only about the lawyers. There's a special category of people, the ethicists, philosophers, that it's basically their job to find all those ethical ramifications and issues.
Kevin, do you want to say something?
I suppose what I'd add is that to Areti's point and the ethics, and especially say around AI and data and, that is all very valid, right? It's human nature playing out. But that's not just the energy industry. That's just society in general, right? We've seen it with the pandemic. We've seen it with vaccine data, sickness data, you name it. So I do think, and rightly or wrongly, the EU with GDPR and data privacy, digital sovereignty, single digital identity, I think we're trying to get there. But I kind of come back to the human nature thing. As cool as we come up with some new technology, somebody else comes up with another way of using it, which we may not have gamed out and go, ooh, that's bad. But mm-hmm. I don't think we'll ever have the answer to that until we try it, right? That's just human nature with the last, whatever, thousands of years.
Well, I guess that comes down to our ability or the need for regulators and policymakers to be fairly flexible in terms of adaptation or changing direction or adjusting direction, because of the fact that human nature in and of itself, it's not a stagnant thing. I mean, people change and situations change and people innovate constantly. And so we need to be able to kind of roll with the punches, I guess, is one way of putting it. It's funny because actually, Areti, you were saying about ethnicities. And I have just listened to a presentation by a woman who is an energy behavior psychologist. That is what she has written her PhD on, is how people engage with energy and waste and how human behavior is impacted and how, you know, behavior change is often underwritten by understanding the behavior you want to change. So I just thought that was a very interesting aside. Perhaps then, Kevin, I could ask you about something, and that is the uptake of renewable energy over the last 25 years. I mean, I had a look at some statistics, which I thought were quite interesting. In 2004, we had 800 gigawatts of installed capacity globally. And this year, we had 2.8 million megawatts. So that's what, 2,800 gigawatts of new renewable energy installed. Thoughts?
So whenever we had 800 gigawatts, if you were looking at probably the most, I would just say, optimistic projections at that time, I'm not sure they would have had 2,800 gigawatts as a goal. That would have been probably seen as science fiction. And yet we're there. So there's been huge growth in the amount of renewables, and be that wind, solar, bio, you name it. And it varies in different parts of the globe. I suppose the challenge is that our entire demand for energy has also increased. I'm not sure which report that is, but if you look at, say, like the total amount of energy we consumed on the planet back then and today, there are two different numbers. So we've also had, you know, it's been like, let's say, I think today we're at 80% of our global energy is still coming from fossil fuel. And whether we like it or not, based on a lot of the projections we have right now, in the next couple of decades, that's going to decline in some sectors more than others, say commercial or consumer transport around electrification of vehicles and stuff. But we're still going to be burning a lot of fossil fuels going forward. But, I kind of come back in that the progress has been huge. The technology advancements, you know, I look at the size of a wind turbine and the complexity of some of them now compared to whatever 10 years ago is fascinating. And they're only getting bigger and better. Advances in solar technology, you name it. But I kind of come back and, you know, when you asked earlier, what are the top two things in the last room? Fracking. If fracking never became a thing in the US, maybe we'd have seen a lot more renewables growth in North America for energy security. You know, fracking made the US, they went from an energy importer to an exporter. Now, they still import some crude oil from Middle East and Russia because of the type of oil and, but they're primarily an energy exporter. So if fracking never happened, potentially we'd have a lot more renewables in the US right now for energy security. But hey, who knows, right? If, but, and maybe.
It's actually a really interesting point, and it does bring me to a related topic, as particularly when it comes to energy security, and that is around the growth of storage. We've seen a huge growth in the amount of storage that is available, the amount of storage that is being implemented on the grid. We've seen a change in attitude to how storage is utilized, how it is factored into thinking nowadays in a way that it wasn't even 5 years ago. So I guess I wanted to just ask, what are your thoughts, not only in terms of how storage has changed, but also what we could potentially anticipate it looking like going forward?
Yes, storage is one of the most important things if we want renewables to be integrated into the smart grid. It's one of the problems also why, if I know this correctly, why we don't have as much renewables integrated into our smart grid as we would like. And it has to do with also how big it should be. I mean, going back to, and I wanted to go back to this for a long time now, to nuclear power. And yeah, you gave me a really nice opportunity here. Going back to nuclear power, if we can think that we have power plants like the Fukushima one or Chernobyl, which was even worse because people are still remembering, those that experienced that incident still remember it and live the consequences of it. We have the power plants, and then on the other hand, we have a nuclear submarine with storage capacities, maybe same as the power plant, but smaller, more compact and safer. So basically, I think that storage was, is, and will be a very huge and important role in our future, not only for renewables, but in general. Let's discuss also data storage. It's a different kind of storage, but it's going to be very important in the future, right? With the big data and everything. So yes, I would say that your question is spot on. It's a very important issue.
That was the most brilliant segue I have ever heard, from storage to nuclear submarines to data storage. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much. So perhaps a question that I think in Europe has certainly started gaining a lot of traction over, I would say, the last 2 years, is starting to see definitely the awakenings of interest in Africa, and that is hydrogen. So, Kevin, do you have any thoughts on the kind of upcoming hydrogen revolution that we are seeing, or that we're supposedly going to see?
So right up front, I'm a big fan of hydrogen. And I suppose let me frame it this way. Hydrogen's not new. We've been using hydrogen for many years, and there are many use cases today in terms of where we need hydrogen as a fuel or a feedstock into chemical industry and all sorts of industries. Where I think it's fascinating now is the whole concept of the electrolyzer technology. So can I take, you know, Arete's point, we don't have enough energy storage to store all the excess wind or solar energy that we might have at a particular time. And in some cases, hydrogen is simply seen as a way of time shifting energy and storing energy. So you start taking electrical energy, you turn it into hydrogen gas, or potentially a hydrogen carrier like ammonia, which is easier to transport around. And suddenly you start changing the dynamics of things. And yes, you can pump hydrogen around as a blend in natural gas pipelines. You can start having complete hydrogen gas networks, but then you need different lining in the pipes and different types of pipes because of the corrosion and. So it's all feasible. I suppose the feature right now is that if you look at the cost model, and it varies depending on the technology, on the location, and it is still quite expensive. The other feature here, and I think where the EU deserves a lot of credit, is their forward thinking around the entire hydrogen economy. Personally, I could make a case that the hydrogen economy for Europe makes Europe energy independent. And it also helps decarbonize a lot of the hard to decarbonize sectors, industrial and. But you end up that we have enough offshore wind around Europe or solar coming from parts of Europe. We turn it into hydrogen. How we ship that around, maybe for shipping. Airbus are looking at using hydrogen for their future planes. And you start getting into almost that kind of circular economy. So I am extremely, I suppose, bullish is the word, in terms of the opportunity for hydrogen going forward. It is not the only answer, because, you know, when we were chatting about this beforehand, I have a different technology for my next 25 years, but hydrogen is here to stay. And I think we're just starting at the cusp of it. But hydrogen is going to be a player.
Kevin Areti, thank you very much for sharing your insights. You've been listening to part one of our conversation about the industry milestones of the past 25 years and the trends of the future. Make sure you don't miss part two to hear more details. For part two or episodes about other interesting topics, you can visit the Smart Energy International website on smart-energy.com. So be sure to tune in again soon for more conversations and insights into the things that really matter to our industry.